Chat with Traders, episode 81.
The biggest secret of the best traders in the world is that they're just like everyone else. However, they've worked hard to learn the markets and discover what works and what doesn't. But how can you hear about these journeys and get in on the strategies and tactics they use? You can do it by listening to Chat with Traders. Here's your host, Aaron Fifield.
We have a really cool sponsor this week, guys. Same as last week, Real Vision TV. If you haven't heard, they're pretty much the Netflix of finance. So I say, quit watching lame TV shows and fill your brain with some real substance from the world's best investors of all markets, literally. From having watched many hours of Real Vision TV, I can honestly tell you, you won't see anything like this in mainstream financial media. So if you go to realvisiontv.com/traders, you can get yourself a free 7-day trial. That's realvisiontv.com/traders for a free 7-day trial. Welcome to another episode, team, and I want to say, just real quick, thanks to everyone who has been tweeting about the podcast over the past few weeks. It's been really awesome to go back and forth with many of you, so thanks heaps. And if you're not following me on Twitter, you can do so at ChatWithTraders. Now, our guest for this week's episode is Alan Farley, who took his first trades in the late 80s. Alan is an active swing trader, and most of his positions take place in the US equity market, although he occasionally trades index futures and currencies too. In 2001, Alan released his first book, The Master Swing Trader, which might just be the best-selling book on the subject. He's also a regular contributor to The Street and Investopedia, having written hundreds of articles over the years. Some of the subjects you'll hear about in just a moment include the unusual way in which Alan got a well-rounded education of financial markets, some of the big lessons that shaped him into the trader he is now, in particular, the concept of convergence and divergence, plus we talk about the dynamics that generate price movement and heaps more too. Anyway, here it is. I'm Aaron Fifield, and this is my conversation with Alan Farley. So how's your day, man? What's going on?
I had a nice day. I had to ask you a question. Do you know Chris Shea?
Chris Shea? No, it doesn't ring a bell. Why is that?
He's a quote-unquote a trading coach in Brisbane. I was in Brisbane in 2005. I did a program for Davin Clark up in Coolum somewhere.
Okay.
And then we went down to Sydney, and Chris Shea was like his partner at the time. They were trying to start some business.
Right. Is he still trading today? Do you know?
Chris, I don't know. I don't think he was ever a trader. He was more trying to do the like Mark Douglas thing, you know?
Okay. Yeah, like more of the psychology kind of mindset aspect of it. Yeah, right.
Yeah, well, and Davin and I had a good time, and, you know, I've seen him since. But that was my trip. They paid for me. It was nice. They paid for me, and I spent 10 days in Australia, and I did some work for them, so I got paid for that as well. So it was kind of cool.
Good stuff. Have you been back since then?
No. Nobody's invited me. Sad, but true.
All right. Well, when I have the big Chat with Traders conference, I'll fly over.
Sure, anytime.
Awesome.
I'm waiting.
So, yeah, no, it's really cool to be speaking with you, Alan. Jeff Davis actually recommended that I try and get you on for an interview. Do you know Jeff?
I don't know where I know half these people from, but I've known Jeff for about somewhere between 5 and 10 years. So you just start communicating with him. My identity and connections have changed so many times that I don't know where people know me from, but I've known him from somewhere. Maybe I met him at like trade shows back in the 1990s.
Okay. You know?
But Jeff's a really good guy. He's really smart too.
Yeah.
And I like him because he teaches me a lot of stuff about very, very short-term things.
Yeah. No, he was awesome. He was really, really cool. We got a lot of great feedback from his interview a couple weeks back. And when I was doing a little bit of poking around on the internet, doing a little bit of prep for this interview, I noticed there's you've done a hell of a lot of writing, especially for like Investopedia, The Street, and those types of sites. How long have you been doing that for?
I started writing for The Street in 2001. In fact, the reason I started working for The Street, and it was after my book came out. I wrote two books. I wrote Master Swing Trader in 2000, and I wrote the Master Swing Trader Toolkit in 2009. So when I wrote the Master Swing Trader, it did really well. That was like December 2000. And things really started to move for me. I actually got back. I took 2001 off because I didn't know how to trade and write at the same time. A problem I've since solved. So I just took off the year and wrote that book. And so I was getting back into trading, and the book was doing really well. And then 9/11 came along, and TheStreet.com lost two people in the World Trade Center.
Oh,
and
wow.
They needed to replace them. I'm one of the people they called. I had Jim Cramer was on the phone. This is like 4 days after 9/11. Jim Cramer's on the phone with a guy I knew from another site from it was called TradingMarkets.com. I wrote for like 6 months, and they asked me to write for him and also to do a newsletter. And I stopped writing a daily column for them in 2012, but the newsletter, which I started in 2002, I've been doing for 14 years now. And that's like an energizer bun. It just goes on, keeps on ticking and ticking and ticking. And so I got to thank you for that. And then after I stopped writing that stuff for The Street, I started writing. Investopedia asked me to do some work for them about 2 years ago, and that's just blossomed. They let me do my thing there, which is write stock analysis after stock analysis and commodity analysis, which is what I love to do. I can whip that stuff out real fast. And it helps me. That's my research at the same time. I trade the same stuff I'm looking at for somebody else most of the time.
For sure. No, that's really cool. All right, Alan, well, probably the first thing I'd like to ask you about and where we'd like to start is how you first got into trading. I think you were in your early 30s when you first came to trading. What got you into this?
Well, I think I was actually a little bit late because my son was born in 1987, and I never had any money management skills. I never owned any stock. I never took any financial courses in college. I did none of that. I had a strong major in math at that time, so I always had a good mathematical background. And after our first child was born, my wife and I were talking. I said, "Well, I need to learn how to invest." This is like, you're right. I mean, I'm a pretty old dad, so I was probably maybe 35, 36 at the time. And so I started from scratch. And the first things that I came across, and I think it was it's so funny, he's born in October 87. The October crash happened 2 weeks after he was born. So, I mean, his timing was pretty spectacular, you know, and that got my interest as well. And I started going to the library on weekends, and I did mostly value line charts. One of the first things I discovered is that how much more I like technical analysis than fundamental analysis. Fundamental analysis, I felt like, okay, I'm not an accountant, I'm going to have to do this my way. And so I started down the TA path, and I learned most of the stuff I learned early on was from going to Barnes & Noble, just sitting there on Saturday and Sunday, picking in their business section, picking up TA books, which are horrendously expensive back then, and sitting there and reading for 3 or 4 hours. And I did that for months. I started to get into some trading, and it was almost the same time. I did a little bit, say, between 88 and 91, 92. But when CompuServe, when E-Trade went to CompuServe, which I think in 93, and that was the first portal where you could sort of do more than one trade every 3 months, I'd been on CompuServe already, and I also hooked up not only with E-Trade, but I also hooked up with the Investors Forum at CompuServe, which was sort of a precursor to America Online. And now back in the day, this is in 1993, there were no sort of like disclaimers for the internet, because the internet it existed, but it didn't have the World Wide Web for its base. So CompuServe had a proprietary interface. Nobody thought twice about talking to each other. And in this Investors Forum were currency traders, Merrill Lynch traders, underwriters, VPs, everybody in this environment in which they could talk freely. They didn't feel like they were sharing trade secrets, because nobody realized that the internet was a big deal then. So it was like a small group of people sharing trade secrets. And I actually learned from a technical analyst from Merrill, was my first teacher there. I then became I loved the online thing, which is obvious from everything I've done since that time. And so I became what was called a SysOp there, which is like SYSOP, a system operator. And so I was the guy, and I shared shifts with other people who would download the entire database between, say, a four-hour period. And then I had to go and filter that database and send it back up as quickly as I could. And we got that down in real time, but you get maybe 400 messages an hour, and so I'd have to scan through 400 messages. And so I started speed reading everything about the financial markets. And I did that for like 3 years. So in addition to the trading stuff, I got a really nice education and everything else because I was reading all the stuff that the bond guys were speaking about and the underwriting guys were speaking about and the sales guys were speaking about. And so it was a real nice rounded education that I got from them. But I really picked up most of them. They had a small trading and technical analysis section. And then I went out on my own with through E-Trade. I'm sure I should probably stop somewhere in here, but the story is really interesting how everything just progressed in a very, very nice pattern. At the time, I was also the boss in a huge claim operation. I had like 150, 175 employees over five states here in the western states. So I was in Denver. I used to go out to Oregon and Utah and Wisconsin and Arizona and California. And I also had the only modem in the office because we got a modem, which was very expensive, in order to send requests to the crime bureau, for fraud. We used it for fraud. And so I had to put the modem in my room. So in addition, in my office, and I was like one of the only people in the office. So in addition to, having one of the first modems, I also had one of the first private connections that I was able to go and hook up all my trading stuff to the company modem. And I did that for 4 years. And believe me, the day that I got laid off from that job, they had no idea what I'd been doing sitting there for 4 years. And at the same time, the company went from like, had 150 employees. And by 1998, which is when I left, I had something like 14 employees. So I used to get done with my work after 1 and 2 hours, collect that salary, and then go and trade for the rest of the day. So it was a really nice start. I was very, very fortunate.
Okay. That's very interesting. And there's a couple of things I'd like to pick up on there. So probably the first thing would be that you came into trading right after the 87 crash. I mean, this was probably a time when I imagine most people were trying to get out of the market and probably scared of the market. Did you have any concerns at that time about starting to trade?
Well, no, you really don't because you're so risk unconscious. You're so risk stupid at that point. You know what I thought the greatest thing in the world was? And this is the first thing I ever picked up. And it was from a newspaper. You picked it up and I just would look at stocks that were like a dollar or under. And I would see, oh, it's got a low this year of 47 cents and it has a high of 73 cents. I can make, 26 cents. All I have to do is buy the low and sell the high. That was my mentality. It wasn't sort of this grand investment scheme. It was just the stuff that I noticed instead of sort of the fundamental, I better get a portfolio and diversify it and, do my MPT and, go in and learn my risk management. The first thing I'm doing is looking at the numbers, which is always my thing. I'm a pattern guy from the word go and seeing these numbers of high, low, open, high, low, close. And that's what got me started. I said, well, if it's going to be low at some point and high at some point, I just have to figure out when it's going to be low and when it's going to be high. So, I mean, I didn't have the risk consciousness. And if you take a look at the 87 crash, it wasn't like the 2000 bear market or the 2007 bear market. And it wasn't really – it was more like the 29 in that it came out of a parabolic rally. So all that happened is you gave up fairly short-term gains. So the market bottomed out very fast after that crash. And still, if you look at it on a blip, and I have a spider here. If I look back at that thing and you go back 20 years, you go back to monthly, I'm not sure you could even see the crash on there. I'm looking, okay, I'm to 1995. Yeah, I'm looking at 1985 to 1990, and you don't see a crash. And that's sort of the way 87 was. It was a very odd animal because the market, I'm going to say you kids today, but, experiencing it, the market was coming out of the Cold War, and everything with the bridge, the walls were falling down, and all these Silicon Tech companies were coming up. It was a very interesting time, and so everybody was very optimistic and upbeat. Plus, we were baby boomers in our 30s just hitting our prime time in capital. We're just starting to make the most money in our lives. So it was just perfect timing for us. I mean, millennials have sort of the opposite timing. They're moving into an environment of, dealing lack versus abundance and the sea levels and pollution and sourcing and all kinds of things in a very manipulated stock market, central bank controlled, HFT controlled capitalism, world capitalism. Different animal in the 1980s when, Steve Jobs was still, not a billionaire, He's probably a millionaire back then, but not a billionaire.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And one of the other things you said, which I found particularly interesting, was the cost of technical analysis books back during that time. Also, I understand that commissions during that time were very expensive as well. Can you give us an idea on how much you would pay for a round trip of commissions, and how did this influence your style of trading when starting out?
No, I just posted a, I found an old thing, I don't know why, it was a Hambrick and Quist, Quist, whatever their name was. I remember they broke up around the turn of the millennium, and they were the discount house back then, and this was something like 92, 93, because it's right when Telecharts was starting out, and so on the same page as they had for Telecharts was the first sort of cheap data vendor. It was, and this is their price. Their cut rate price was $50 in and $50 out. And that was for 100 shares. There was a scale after 100 shares. So not only did you have that, you had on top of that, you had to pay more for each 100. Plus, you had the spread, and the spread was going to be 19 in NASDAQ in the 1990s. The spread was 50 cents, 75 cents. So you were assumed that if you're going to buy something, you're going to hold it for a couple years and then sell it, because you had to get past that transaction cost, and you needed that time for the transaction to eat up the transaction cost. And so, yeah, it was a 50 each way. So what you did was that your stock certificates were like they were like your diploma in high school. You put them in a draw, you know, and you looked at them from time to time, and then you got value line week to week, and you look at the chart. If you were a TA guy, is it an uptrend or downtrend, or if you're a Dow theory guy. And, you know, I mean, E-Trade changed all that with discount fees, and they were still expensive. I think it was, what, $29.95 each way or $25 each way to start out. Even going up into 98 to 2000, I remember the heyday of the level two shops. It was, maybe you saw $19.95 each way, $20 each way. And that was the same time you were starting to get all the rebates with all the different guys coming in with Instanet and all the names. I can't remember the names. They all were bought out by each other. And so if you routed it one way, it was one fee. If you routed it another way, it was a different fee. So, yeah, but the cost structure was coming down. It really collapsed after the bear market in 2000 to 2002. And for me, it was Interactive Brokers. They were just they just wiped out everybody else. Maybe they weren't the first, but they did it best in terms of bringing it down to a buck or under for 100 shares.
Yeah. I mean, that's so crazy to think that, you know, a round trip of commissions was over $100 plus a really wide spread, you know, only, what, 20, just over 20 years ago. You know, we now complain if it's anything more than a few bucks. So that's really interesting to hear about. So how did that affect your trading? Like, how long were you holding positions for, you know, obviously having to factor those transaction costs in? How long were you holding trades for on average back then?
So 2 to 3 months minimum. I didn't even think about day trading until maybe 98, 99. And even in 98, 99, it was way too expensive for me. And I was out full-time trading at that point. You know, it was just, to me, it was, I don't want to flip. You know, yeah, I'll have to flip what 30 times a day, and I'm going to have what $6,000 in transaction costs that I have to overcome in order to make a profit. I mean, you know, I want to live to be a ripe old age, and that's not the way to do it. You're going to get real stressed out if you do that. And I know a lot of friends who made lots and lots of money and really burned out badly because of, you know, the high intensity of it. They couldn't maintain that. So that's why, I mean, I focus on swing trading, which has always been my thing. I mean, the swing trading to me, and at the very beginning, I wasn't sure exactly what swing trading was because I didn't really see much of a difference between day trading and swing trading. Swing trading is more like position trading, but position trading was too – the definition in many people's minds was too long. That was like weeks to months. So swing trading is more like days to weeks. And I've been in a fortunate position where I've been able to contribute to the definition of swing trading by writing – probably, I think it's still the best-selling book on swing trading that's ever been written, Master Swing Trader. I was told, because McGraw-Hill never told me the exact sales figures, but they told me it was the best-selling book in their textbook division between 2000 and 2010, and the best-selling market book in their textbook division. So, you know, that to me tells me that it affected a lot of people, but I really don't know. I never asked for that, for the exact figures of it. But so in a position like that, not only could I define swing trading, but I've done my best to try to define things like double tops, double bottoms, support and resistance, cup and handle patterns, Fibonacci levels, all this stuff in which there's some sort of Catholic way of looking at stuff. For example, with O'Neill and the cup and handle, it's got a, you know, the the handle has to go back to this extension, and it can't go to that extension, and it has to be this long versus this long. Well, you know, the market's not going to give you all that. The market's going to give you 80% of that, and the 80% of that translates into a 5 or 10 or 15% edge, you know? So that's always interested me. So I've gone and done my best to redefine it. I've said it so many times now, and not only in the books, but being able to put it in something with a PD on the name of it, at the end of its name, that it'll find its place into history. And that's one of my ego goals, you know, is to be able to do that, to contribute to the dialogue on the financial markets in the same way that maybe Eliot did back in the 1930s, you know? That's all I wanted to accomplish, and I think I've probably done that by putting a whole bunch of stuff out there that should have changed definitions.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I got to say, congrats on the huge success of the book. We're definitely going to dig into that a lot more very shortly. One of the things I want to ask you about while we're still covering your path to becoming the trader you are today, I think you mentioned at the beginning that you had a teacher or a mentor who was a technical analyst from Merrill Lynch.
Yeah.
How did you link up with him, and what were some of the big things that he really tried to drum in and teach you about?
His name was John Yurko. He was from Bayonne, New Jersey, and you can imagine that even Australia, they probably know about Bayonne, New Jersey, which is one of the cancer hotspots of the country. And John, in fact, you know, passed away when I knew him from complications of his environment. So John, yeah, he was the technician at Merrill Lynch, and he had to leave in his last years because he was a very advanced diabetic and his vision started to go. But he taught me about levels. And he taught me to think contrary. He taught me which indicators to use to keep it very, very simple. He taught me how to use indicators in conjunction with each other. Some very, very basic tools, but more about the price pattern, the price pattern rules. From the price pattern creates the indicators, not the other way around. You're using the indicators in order to improve your vision. And not just for confirmation, not just for signals, because if you rely on signals, you're not going to see all the gray between green and red, you know? And so he taught me to really pay attention to the price structure. So I believe I've gotten more out of that from him than anyone else. My other fantastic teacher, and I'm sure I'm probably missing half your question, but it's a good point to bring it up, was Linda Rashke. Linda, her full name, Linda Bradford Rashke, one of the market wizards, and someone who I had dinner with in 2000, and the last time I saw her was probably 2008, 2009. She calls me by my first name, and that makes me feel fantastic because I think she's one of the most awesome TA and trading people in existence. But she taught me about convergence divergence, which is, you know, you try to – I've got my share of Twitter followers. You try to jam it into their heads about convergence divergence. You try to repeat the lesson in 10 different ways so that everybody from every sort of blockage they have in their brain and their heart, they could see what I'm talking about with convergence divergence, and still they don't get it. And convergence divergence is godly, meaning that you could translate that into money. And so it's a very, very important concept that comes straight from her. And she also taught me another thing, which is about volatility, expansion, and contraction. My first book talks about positive and negative feedback systems, which is sort of an offshoot of trends and ranges. And when you're in a range, like we're in a massive, disgusting range since 2014, you know, at some point, and it's like at the last third of every trading range, it starts to go from a negative feedback into a positive feedback where the signals start to pile on top of one another, you know, and it becomes a stairs that the price is climbing on. And that sort of positive feedback system, if you pick that up early, you get into breakouts or breakdowns much, much earlier than the signals are going to be. You're going to be in that thing days before you get your sort of signals from that stuff. And that's always been mine to be, you know, the old trading adage about how you're supposed to react, not anticipate. There's a whole school on that. To me, it's you anticipate rather than react. You get your technicals as perfect as possible, and then you find your spot, and hopefully no one else is there when you get to that spot.
Yeah, yeah, and I've got to say, Linda is really awesome. She was actually on the podcast, I think it was episode 48, so if anyone listening wants to listen to that episode, just go chatwithtraders.com/48, and you can hear an interview with Linda Rashke right there. Now, I feel like I should probably ask you to expand on convergence, divergence a little more. Like, why is this so important that we really understand this concept?
I'll go straight to Linda's definition of it. Convergence divergence is created by any 2 points. Any 2 points in the market are going to either agree with each other or they're going to disagree with each other. Now, there's so much you can do with that. Someone who can't filter is going to go, well, then everything is going to be convergent divergent with everything else. But so if you have analytical skills, you're going to go, well, some things are more important to be convergent than other things. Convergence, again, is when 2 points are doing the same thing, and divergence when 2 points are doing a different thing. A bearish convergence is when the thing that's weak is doing something that it should have done that was strong, and a bullish divergence is the thing that's supposed to be weak is doing something that's stronger than you expected. So I know that's a kind of definition that's going to – some folks are going to take 10 years to figure that out. But, I mean, it's really nothing more than a 10-second little equation. But convergence divergence, classically, it's going to be – I use it in probably two, maybe three different ways. Number one, I use three main financial instruments, and that's the S&P 500, NASDAQ 100, and Russell 2000. Those three are going to form convergence divergence relationships up the yin-yang. And if you go back, start at 2000 and just go month by month and look at the convergence-divergence relationships created by pure Dow theory, which one is leading the other one in price, which one has broken out to a new high or fallen to a new low compared to the other one, which one is leading a rally, which one is a laggard in a rally. That's all. That's godly information, too. That's why a week before the S&P 500 topped out 6-7 days ago, my whole thing was as an S&P 500 rally, the NASDAQ 100 is lagging, which means it's a bearish divergence, and in that bearish divergence, you're not going to get a breakout. The S&P 500 can break out, can hit a new high, but no one's going to follow it. And so you're going to get some sort of weird new high that's going to trigger a failed breakout. So a convergence divergence relationship. Russell 2000, which is small caps in the States, you know, it's slightly different animal. Sometimes it's very important, and sometimes it's not important, and that takes years and years of, you know, tape reading. But anybody who wants to look at the NASDAQ versus the S&P 500, that's where you start. The second one is with some very simple relative strength oscillators. Two main relative strength oscillators are stochastics. I use some RSI, Wilder's RSI, but mostly stochastics. Keep it simple. George Lane, what was it, 1960s, he put that together. And if you become a student of stochastics, it will guide you for the rest of your life. So stochastics in which there's buy and sell cycles. So convergence and divergence is how is price moving in respect to daily, weekly, and monthly buy and sell cycles. So we're on a monthly buy cycle. Everything's on a monthly buy cycle after January and February bottom. So if price is falling, that's going to be a bullish divergence compared to the monthly buy cycle. So that's when you start to look at pullbacks and dips and buying lower prices. But you also have a weekly because it's a three-dimensional chessboard. And the weekly is getting oversold on a lot of stuff. And so, you know, it's that chessboard of figuring out where you buy if you're trying to buy pullbacks. If you have convergence in the indices where everything is strong and you're trying to do trend following, or everything is weak and you're trying to do trend following. You know, and you take a look at September 2008 and see where they were, where the averages were in respect to each other, in respect to the highs and lows in the past 18 months, and it predicted that after the Paulson's failure in September 2008 he stopped short sales with the banks or something, that the market had hit a big high, banks hit a monstrous high. It was like a massive short squeeze. It was like 15-20%. And the market collapsed into October. Well, it collapsed and went into that positive feedback loop to the downside, all on convergence-divergence relationships that locked into convergence. Everything, NASDAQ said I'm selling, the S&P 500 said I'm selling, everything said it was selling. And then at that point, the secondary markets fall apart because, you know, I was focused on equities at that point. At this, you know, in this world, you focus on everything. But at that point, the secondaries followed. Then crude oil followed, and the metals followed, and everything followed except for the fear stuff. You know, that's when in December 2008. That's when the bonds took off. You know, because that was the bond trade. That's where it started. So anyway, that's convergence and divergence. A third way that it's used is actually in conjunction with Bollinger Bands. Because Bollinger Bands are two things. They're volatility. It's a volatility indicator, but it's also a relative strength indicator. Because you're looking at price's relationship compared to a top and bottom band and a central mean or a mean reversion point. I call it a central tendency point. It's the if you stretch the rubber band, it's going to flop back to the 20-day SMA or whatever he uses, your for your time frame in Bollinger Bands. And so if price is stretched too far, that's a I got to get this straight. That's a bearish divergence because it's stretched outside the top Bollinger Band, which means it's gone too far too fast and it's overbought and that kind of thing. So that's a bearish divergence. That's a bearish divergence. You know, when it does that. So, but that's the relationships you get into.
Yeah, okay. And I presume, considering the amount of articles you've written over the last, 14, 15 years, that you've probably written something about this, which maybe has some visual examples. Maybe if you've got something like that, we'll dig it up and we'll link to it in the show notes. How does that sound?
Yeah, it's my. If you go just to my contributor under investopedia.com, and I'll send you a link for that.
Okay.
And cool. That hooks up all my articles. It's got all the article listing. And the current number is, and this is kind of awesome because this is pure ego and absolutely nothing else. My number is, I think, 338 articles now that I've written for them since October of 2014.
Wow.
It's kind of fun.
It's a solid effort.
That's a badge of honor. That's all.
That's a lot of writing. Okay, so just before we get into more of the specifics about how you trade today, one of the things that I'd like to ask about is, even though, and I'd like to ask most guests who come on, even though you had these mentors, like you mentioned, the technical analysis guy at Merrill Lynch and even Linda Rashke, even with these mentors and this guidance, what were some of the biggest challenges or setbacks that you had to push through as a developing trader?
Losing money constantly. That's a pretty big setback. Yeah, I mean, honestly, for the first two or three or four years, everything I tried Everything I tried didn't work. I lost lots of money. And the thing that's turned me around is losing some of my passion and not being losing some of my excitement and my passion and losing my fear at the same time and concentrating on the numbers and letting the numbers guide me rather than, oh my God, we're going to go bankrupt and we're going to have to sell the house, you know? And once you concentrate on the numbers, you concentrate on levels, and you start concentrating on seeing that everybody else is your competition, not your friend. Everybody's your competition, not your friend. And I could thread that needle because I'm also a teacher, so I could separate out the two. And I also mentor other people, but there's certain things I keep for myself still. There's certain things where, you know, that I try to get out there, but I just keep those for myself, little bits and pieces of my systems and how things have worked over the years that I'll probably wind up never sharing with people because the bottom line is, you know, the Farleys have to eat, you know. I was still working in the insurance industry during those 4 years when I was losing money, so I was getting it back. I was very, very protected. I was losing money every year. But my last years with the insurance company, I was making six figures, so I was getting the money back. I was keeping the trading account size up. Then I lost that job. I didn't ask to lose it. I lost it, and that was trouble. I had a hard time for the first 3 months, and then I started getting my equilibrium, and I started to become a break even trader for the next couple of years. And no one's going to like this answer. But at this point, now I've been doing it for so long that I can actually give the answer, and it's an answer which is probably poison for trading educators. I make money now because I don't have to trade all the time. I make money because I don't need it. I make money every year. My returns are ridiculously good because it doesn't matter as much anymore. That's something which is very it's a great truth of my life, you know, which I wasn't able to make money consistently until I had other sources of money. Mm. And that's what worked for me, that I was able to reduce my passion because it wasn't like, well, God damn it, if I don't do something this week or next week, the family's going to suffer. Well, as soon as I did that, my returns, even down to a daily level, they blossomed. It makes me crazy. But that was really the thing, was sort of giving that up and giving up the passion I had for the market. That was the thing that's turned it around for me for sure. You know, and that again didn't come until I came back to trading after 2001. Things started to, because the other stuff took off, and I said, well, what the hell? I was still trading, and all of a sudden the trading started doing well too. It also it saved my ass, you know. you talk about the difference between needing it and wanting it. In 2007, I'd built up a really nice retirement account. And I was just putting the trading earnings and the writing stuff into a large SEP account, which was that's like IRA here, self retirement account. And it was a Schwab, and at that time Schwab salespeople were real pushy. I had them put in July of 2008, take everything I had already gone into cash. I had them take everything out of money markets that they wanted to put me in. I just had them put me into whatever the sweet money market was. And I said, I just want cash. I want nothing else. Because, I mean, the market worried me. And then I missed the crash. I missed it completely. I had exactly the same amount of money in March and April of 2009 as I did in July of 2008. And that was because that I didn't have to make it there. If the market was going to crash, I could let it crash. I'll just go to cash. My newsletter was 100% short. I play on the short side as much as I want. I don't like playing on the short side when volatility is 50, 60, 70. I can't handle those swings. And that's what it was like on some days back in the fourth quarter of 2008. And then in March of 2009, from that level head and all that money back in there, I started buying. I bought Apple. I made 380 points on Apple between 2009 and 2012 or 13 when I sold it. It was some ridiculous number. I made 100 points, 120 points on IBM. You know, the stuff that came out of that was just ridiculous, you know. And it was because I didn't have to trade 2008 if I didn't want to. And that was a very big lesson for me as well. The return since 2009, I had trouble in 2010 and 2011 because of the algos. You know, the robots took over, and the flash crash was the first time we realized the robots were there. I mean, we knew where they were there, but that's when they exerted their influence and you realized that the robots were really dangerous. And after the flash crash in May of 2009, I started to be at peace with them. I put out an olive branch. I complain and bitch about them, but that's what the new market's like. That's they used to call it the axe back in the level two times, you know. The algos are the axe, and if you can read what the algos are doing, whether it's just sort of sweeping out stops or front-running little movement or trying to make sucker moves retail at highs and lows, which they do all the time, if you just sort of get a read of that, you know, your life is a lot easier. You don't have to be long every day. You just wait for the big stuff. Like tomorrow's a big day, you know. And really being in peace with them has improved my returns the last 4 or 5 years. It's been really awesome. It's a ridiculous market. It's one that's real hard to trade to people. But if you know how to trade it, it's really not that hard, you know. That's a very funny sort of dichotomy that anybody who sort of has to tell other people what the market does. That's a private joke. It's not that we mean to do it. But it's so hard to explain that. When you explain it, people look at you with sort of those dead eyes and go, you know, they don't understand you. But if you just are at peace with the algos and just let them play their games, they're not bad masters either. You know, they're really not very bad masters at all.
That's actually a topic I want to bring up with you in a little bit when we get into breakouts, because I think it'll be very relevant to that subject. One of the things I found very interesting in your response there is you said that you became a much better trader once your passion for trading started to sort of back off a little bit. Seems quite the opposite from what most people would say is you've got to be very passionate about this to, you know, succeed as a trader. You're sort of saying that when your levels of passion sort of dropped a little bit, you actually became a better trader. I don't know if that's because you were sort of coming at this with a different perspective.
I think it's a prerequisite for success, actually. I think if you're too passionate, you can make money, but you're going to lose it too. You have to overcome your greed. I don't know which is harder for people, greed or fear. I mean, I know it's sort of like there's so many cliches tied to it, but it's really, really hard to tell people. You've got to detach from both of the stuff. You know, you get the greed and the fear. And the more you do that, your systems may work. You don't know if your system's going to work or not until you look at it without those blinders on. And of course, there's professional traders, there's people who do it every day, and that's something that we have our handle on, you know. But the majority, and you see them, they struggle, and they hide the fact they're in a struggle, especially because of so many white males who trade, that they're the ones that don't want to admit it. They don't want to show their sensitivity. They don't want to admit that they're wrong. But you know that they're losing money. So, you know, you're compassionate, and you have to. I don't say I was. Was it easy or hard for me? I just had the opportunity to not be greedy or fearful. Other people have to do it their own way if they want to succeed. You could be, you know, passionate. Passion is good, but passionate gets you to the starting line in a lot of ways. You want to get, you're trying to play catch up with passionate. At some point, when you become a master at your skill, it's not really passion as much as you better damn well do what your skill tells you to do 100% of the time, or else you're in trouble. You know, that's more important than your passion at that point. You're passionate because you're an aspirant as opposed to a master or a journeyman or a advanced adherent. I mean, whatever, according to your profitability. You know, aspirants are the most passionate. New money, you're passionate. You know, regular good P&L, you feel real good about that. And then when it becomes, you know, a part of your life energy, in other words, you need it to pay the bills, you got to be a lot less passionate about it because you can't risk losing it as much. There's always the risk is there, but you have to cradle it more. It also means taking less risks. It also, for different people, that means different things. And for some people, it means size. For some people, it means holding period. Some people, it means the markets they trade. For me, it's mostly keeping track of how much I keep in cash at any time. Because, I mean, I like to trade, so I always like looking at my cash hoard and saying, you know, that's stuff that's not being risked. And that's how I manage it.
Yeah, no, I think that's really well said, Alan. I like that answer. Okay, here we go. I'd like to give a mention to our sponsor for this episode, Real Vision TV. A, because they're paying me to do so, and B, because their channel plain and simply rocks. Although Real Vision TV is the video on demand channel your partner will probably despise you for subscribing to. No, not because it's X-rated material, but it's that quote-unquote boring finance stuff that we traders and investors get G'd up about. Not to mention, it's highly addictive. What Real Vision TV have created here is the go-to source for exclusive presentations and interviews with incredibly bright minds in financial markets, all who actually have skin in the game and practice what they preach. And I know this is my inner designer speaking now, but Real Vision TV have done a remarkable job of the visuals and interface for the platform too. It's been very well executed. The login page gets me every time. Now, here's what I'd like you to do. Go to realvisiontv.com/traders where you can get a free 7-day trial. If you like it, awesome. If you don't, that's totally fine too. Just cancel before your trial runs out and you won't be charged a penny. Again, that's realvisiontv.com/traders to grab yourself a free 7-day trial and start streaming right now. So moving on, you've been trading for, I think it's coming up to 30 years now. Could you tell us a little bit about how you trade today? Like obviously you've read in the book, Master Swing Trader. Are you still swing trading to this day, or do you also do a little bit of day trading as well? Like tell us a little bit about your approach today.
I day trade when I have to. And I day trade when I see it. If I see something that looks like a day trade, I'll take it because, I mean, I want to take it. You know, I get that excitement and jump in and take care of it. Other times I'll day trade and I just don't trust the market. So in other circumstances, I consider overnight risk, and if there's too much risk, I'll dump it and take the money. And I take a lot of heat in my newsletter. It's a swing trading newsletter. When I say, oh, yeah, by the way, I day traded, so I really don't have anything for you today. And I take a lot of heat for that. But day trading is a form of risk management when you're a swing trader. You day trade so you don't have to hold things overnight so that some poll about Brexit comes out that kills you in the morning. So, yeah, I mean, you day trade as if because at the end of the day, you're not going to have to deal with it. And so, you know, I don't day trade all the time. I much prefer holding positions overnight. I'm holding the NASDAQ 100 overnight right now. That's a swing trade. It's gone down for a week, and I'm trying to pick a bottom. That's one definition of a swing trade. I've got bullish divergences up the yin yang where I'm at here now. So I mean, that's a swing trade for me. It'll only work. I don't think it works if you sell it tomorrow unless you have to. It hits your stop loss. If it works in terms of upside, I probably, unless I get a spike tomorrow, I might have to hold it till Thursday or Friday. So, you know, I'm not sure how long I'm going to hold it, but it's definitely a swing trade. I'm looking to buy this when I want it and then sell when things get wild, which hopefully they will during triple witching at least. So yeah, you pick a spot for that. I'm holding, I'm holding some pullbacks on breakouts. I love pullbacks more than any other things. I don't trade continuation trades in this market. I haven't traded a clean breakout trade in forever. You trade it from level A to level B, and then you get out. Or you trade it from level A, and then you stop out. You know, the breakouts are failing left and right. So it's nice to be positioned when you get the breakout, but it's also nice to sell the breakout because you expect or suspect that it's not going to hold up. So, you know, a lot of timing stuff. It's, again, very tough to teach other people. I'm pretty comfortable with it, and I try to teach other. I teach folks about it all the time, and hopefully they get the message on it.
And what markets and products are you trading? Obviously, you mentioned the NASDAQ 100 there, so you're trading the indices.
American stocks, we're so spoiled. American stocks are just, to me, it's godly. I don't have to go to any other markets. Because I could trade, if I want to trade gold, I'll trade GLD. If I want to trade copper, I'll trade JJC. I won't trade USO or UNG if I want to trade energy markets because contango just wipes you out. I'll probably trade like Halliburton or whatever, you know, stock of the day kind of thing. But U.S. stocks, I mean, you know, futures is a special animal. I'm just not a specialist in futures. I'm a specialist in equities. I know things about them other people don't know. So I keep an advantage with it. I follow Forex. I traded it for a couple of years. I don't want to get up at 2 in the morning. I really don't. You know, I mean, the euro moves all the time. I traded the Aussie market, Aussie dollar, for a long time. I really enjoyed it because here it was like about 6 till 9 o'clock. It was fun, you know. And I really like it better than a lot of other markets. But I got stuck. I just, if you do Forex, do Forex. What I have a hard time is listen to Forex guys try to understand the S&P 500. Good luck with that. Good luck with that, you know. Come see me sometime if you think you're going to understand it. You know, there's a precious few who can, but if you're a Forex guy, you know, I'll learn about the euro from you, but if you want to learn about the S&P 500, you need to come to me, you know. And so I like that. And it also builds a nice community. There are a lot of people here in the States. It's all we do because it's what we got. You know, one thing about Australia, too, is always resource centered like Brazil, and I spent time in Sao Paulo too. And just you can't avoid trading resource stocks in Australia. I don't know how it's even possible, unless I guess you're a Forex trader. But even then, you're trading resource stocks because you're trading the Aussie trades like a resource stock, like, you know, the Mexican peso, you know, and so it's to me, I like the versatility of U.S. markets. You know, okay. Still, we still have 8,000 things to trade.
Yes, there's definitely a wide selection. Plenty to choose from. So I think I read this on your site or I heard you talking about it in a video, and I thought it would be really interesting to bring up here, seeing as we're talking about swing trading. And you said that many traders get into trades without actually understanding the dynamics of what makes those positions move. So could you speak to us a little bit about the dynamics that generate price movement and what we need to understand about that sort of concept?
Okay, two sides, and that number one is the price structure itself, and number two, where you get on board and where you exit the price structure. There, a classic sort of, we'll call it TA 101, classic sort of horizontal line that's support and resistance, and as soon as price exceeds that support and resistance level, it constitutes a breakout. And breakouts are bought through a breakout strategy and a breakout stop loss, and you risk this percentage according to a breakout strategy. And to me, that stuff is just so, I'll call it 1980s. It's so not, doesn't work anymore, and you'll get killed doing it. The price structure dictates what's going on at a breakout, a breakdown level, assuming you're identifying the breakout and breakdown level. Classic example, since we don't have examples here, we're dealing with audio, and we're going to have to describe it. A stock comes back to an old high. So that high's been there for 18 months. Comes back to that high after 18 months. That high is at $60. When it goes down to 30, 35, builds a base, comes back up to 60. Goes to 61, people buy it. And I'm going, why? There's nothing that says that stock won't turn around and come right back down. That doesn't constitute a breakout. The breakout is constituted by the price action that goes into that level. And so you could get almost anything into that level. You could get the fifth wave exhaustion climax of an Elliott 5 wave into that level. You can get you could get three little bases that go up at 50, 55, and 58, so that it's been at 58 already for 3 months. And so when it goes from 58 to 59, 60 doesn't look like a lot. It's just going to go straight through, and you get this legitimate wide-range breakout, this big, tall bar, volume coming in, excitement makes the evening news. Because you already had built up those levels, the price structure had put the wind at your back. It was a tailwind. At the time that you reach a breakout or a breakdown level, you have to go through a series of tests. The series of tests are, does the volume support the breakout or breakdown? Do the relative strength cycles support the breakout or breakdown? Does the structure of the rally into that level support the breakout or breakdown? Does the this is the tricky one, number four. Does the market support the breakout or breakdown? In other words, if you're the S&P 500 and you're at the lower half of the trading range, and one of the S&P 500 components is traded to the top because it's a relatively strong sector. Let's say it's some food stock that doesn't care that the banks are doing bad. When that food stock breaks out and the S&P 500 is sitting and selling off that day, do you really want to own that food stock? Or are the HFTs going to get you because they're going to execute highly correlated ETF strategies that sell the entire component base in order to drag down the index? So that's the background. That's number four. Does the S&P 500, is it a bullish or bearish divergence at the time that you're looking at a breakout or breakdown? Breakouts and breakdowns, to me, occur in three stages. Legitimate, quote-unquote, we'll call it legitimate. And each of one has trades tied to it. You have sort of the action phase in which price lifts off, exceeds a prior high, goes under a prior low. Then you have sort of the identity of that breakout. Some of them will, you know, it'll be a big gap, big volume, big high. That identity is going to create some sort of climax, some sort of high. And I could be very close to the old breakout level. Then you have a reaction phase. The momentum that created that breakout is passed, and now sort of the other side's coming in and going, well, I'm holding the position. Do I want to get out now? Short sellers are going, well, as it run out of steam, do I want to sell now? Technicians are looking at it and going, oh, I've got divergences. Do I want to redo my call now and send out a downgrade or an upgrade? And so that whole process is going on. It's a reaction phase. Reaction phase is sort of a classic buy the dip phase. That in a legitimate breakout, when something comes back to a big breakout level, you want to own it. You want to own it because, damn it, you really wanted to own it when it happened. And now it's come back to that price, and all the technicals are good. You want to be an owner. So that's the reaction phase, legitimately. And that reaction phase can take place in lots of different ways. Then you have the confirmation stage of when price comes back to the high of the initial breakout. Now, when price comes down, this is another thing when you get into fractals, it makes people's minds crazy. When price gets back to the high of the initial breakout, it is, in essence, returning in a smaller fractal of doing the same thing it did when it broke out. It's coming back to an old high. So, but instead of looking on a weekly chart, you're looking on a 60-minute chart or a daily chart. But the same processes are in motion about that high being exceeded and going to an action-reaction cycle. But anyway, speeding up the story, when price exceeds that confirmation high, it's quote-unquote confirmed. It confirms the breakout in the larger scale. So that weekly breakout is confirmed when that higher high is exceeded, theoretically. There's a lot of ifs, ands, and buts, and bruises and bumps in what the action, reaction, resolution, or climax, or confirmation cycle is going to produce. But theoretically, what happens, and it happens quite often, is when that hits the confirmation stage, it's like dominoes. The daily is going to hit a confirmation stage, that 60 minutes is going to hit a confirmation stage, and you're going to get bullish convergence. And what happens in bullish convergence? Price surges forward, and you have a very nice confirmation trade, which is a trend-following trade, which is happening in smaller time frames, but we're not seeing in weekly and daily because we're stuck in a big trading range.
So you kind of described, what was it, four factors that sort of make for a solid breakout opportunity, and then the three phases of a breakout once it actually happens. So whereabouts in all of that do you prefer to enter into this trade? Like you said, it's not ideal to enter just at the break of a line of resistance or support. So Whereabouts in these in this phase do you ideally take a position?
Well, there's at least four different trades here, and I'm looking. Depending, I mean, at any given time, if I'm watching it and this is undergoing a process, this is how I would trade it. If I thought the breakout was legitimate, I try it again before the breakout and take it higher. If I saw the breakout happen and I wasn't in it, I'm not going to chase and I'm going to let it find its high and pull back. If I'm in it, letting it find its high and pull back, I'm very focused on the breakout trade, on the pullback trade, which is what I've been doing the last couple of days with the market dropping here in the States. So I've been very much involved in buying pullbacks in breakouts. If I'm a skeptic and I get this wrong and I'm long overnight and I'm wrong and the market gaps down, I'm looking at failure trades. It could be that a pullback gaps through a breakout level and it drops right into the 50-day EMA and a major Fibonacci retracement. It could be I will get a stronger sell signal on a pullback or a gap down in the morning than the buy. I got to back up a second because I'm going to give it to you wrong. It may be I'll get a stronger buy signal on a gap down in the morning than the buy signal I got today that brought me into the position that I'm holding overnight. So I'll say that again. I may get a stronger buy signal on a gap down into a major level tomorrow morning than the buy signal I got today that brought me into the trade. That gap down into a buy signal is a failure strategy or a failure swing. In other words, some failures will go and produce buy signals, not necessarily when they fail, but if they come into a major average, you may want to take a shot at a 50-day moving average, or when they leave behind something like a bullish island reversal and gap back into that same pattern that I got stopped out of the first time, then you will get a supplementary sell signal. So there's like a third trade right in there, maybe even a fourth trade right in there. And then a fifth trade would be, if I bought a dip trade was to sell the test of the high of the breakout. But then if it broke out from that high of the breakout, the confirmation trade there would give me a fifth or a sixth trade on it. Am I going to take all five or six trades on any given thing? No, I'm watching dozens of stocks and patterns and everything. I'm going to take a little bit here, a little bit there, take a little smorgasbord, little sort of buffet of the stuff that's working today. And today it might be breakout trades. After the Fed, it might be a continuation strategy. So I'm trying to be in tune with the S&P 500 and NASDAQ 100 and Russell 2000 are today.
Okay. So you kind of described six different trading opportunities within a breakout or breakdown scenario there. You know, for someone who's maybe a little bit less experienced or someone who's only been trading a couple years and still kind of learning the ropes, would you suggest that they just try and maybe, if breakout trading is something that really appeals to them, do you think it would be a good idea that they just try and pick one or two of those out of the six trades that you described there and really focus on those? Or, you know, I'm sort of presuming it could be quite easy to get caught up in trying to watch too many things at once.
Yeah, and if you're going to get if you're going to go to one or two of those strategies, you better become really good at it. And you also need to learn the tests and filters you need to place that position through in order to get the right information. Because there's certainly every breakout's going to come with a set. It's any diagnostic. If you can't do diagnostics on the trade you want to take, then you shouldn't take the trade in the first place. And diagnostics is the TA that you trust. You're going to look at the things you look at to tell you whether you believe price is going to move in the direction you think it's going to move in. For me, it's where's stochastics? Where's the 5-3-3 on my three time frames? Where's on balance volume? If it's a daily trade, and I only use on balance volume in daily scale. Is on balance volume supporting a daily scale breakout? Where are the Bollinger Bands? Does the breakout push the Bollinger Band through the top of the top band, you know, right away sending it into an overbought status, which is kind of dangerous to buy into. So, I mean, I've got my quantitative and qualitative information that I'm applying at each of these testing points, and if it doesn't meet my criteria, I'm not interested in the trade. And that's, you know, if you want to do it for – it's not even do it for a living. If you want to be consistently profitable, that's what you're going to have to do. So if that causes you to be forced into like a little bit more research, it's a research you're going to have to take if you want to trade. You're not going to find sort of easy way out. But, yeah, for your first couple of years, you probably want to – You want to look at the entire process because that process could be bread and butter for you. But you're also going to want to decide, well, you know, it's like me. I like dip trades better than anything else. Doesn't everybody? Dip trades are fun. You know, so, you know, pullbacks to support levels are fun. But, you know, you want to know, especially why you're wrong. You know, why are you wrong when you're wrong? That's the losses give you as much information. And what kind of do you go into? I've been in some volatile markets when, you know, you'll get some dip where, you know, look what's to hear Tesla Motors is just getting clobbered in the past few days. You get some sort of like wild price action. You go, do I really want to put my money into that situation where I could be 3-4 points wrong in the space of 3 minutes? So, you know, it's like, okay, you know, so you have to decide what your risk tolerance is at the same time, you know, in addition to which you're going to trade.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, no, great answer. So just moving off that a little bit, I'd like to ask you a few things about stops. So how do you think about where to place your stop losses? You know, many traders are concerned with stop gunning and, you know, brokers knowing where their stops are and that sort of thing. Is that really a genuine concern that people should have? And what's an obvious... Yeah, you go.
I think it's a massive concern. I don't think you should place physical stop losses. I mean, that's you know, I'm sure you're also talking about mental stop losses, but physical stop losses, yes, I don't think they should be placed. Here in the States, it's an invitation to disaster. If you can't watch the market all the time, that's a problem. Okay, and maybe you want to put in sort of an end of the world stop loss, but an end of the world stop loss, as we saw during the flash crashes in May 2011 and in August 2015, because, you know, the industry is reluctant to call that a flash crash, those stops are subject to stop running. So, you know, it's a different question from where it goes, because I certainly have mental stop losses. I know where I want to be out of a trade. You know, you have your reasons for being in a trade, and there should be technical, numerical reasons. When those numerical reasons are broken, you need to be out of the trade. That could be a moving average. That could be a trend line. There's nothing wrong with that. It could be a Fibonacci retracement. I'm Fibonacci crazy. I use Fibonacci on everything. And but you also want to look at sort of a, let's call it an opportunistic stop loss, where you're willing to get out of any trade just because the market's doing something that's wacky and you don't understand. And so, you know, you go, okay, this is a. I think I need to be out. Maybe this isn't the best price. I'm going to try to just get the best price in this sort of time frame, given the circumstances I have, and I'm going to go back to the sidelines. And so that's sort of an opportunity cost stop where you just don't know what you're getting into. So you're eating the cost of the transaction to get back to the sidelines. And I do. I trigger that sort of stop endlessly. It may be the majority of my trades.
Okay. I mean, not placing a stop loss, to me, that just sounds very dangerous.
Yeah, it's not dangerous at all if you're watching the market all day. You're in a much better position if you're not watching the market all day than if you're placing a physical stop loss. Now, are you watching the market and do you know your positions? If you've got 10 thumbs and you don't know your positions, it's one thing. I'll place a physical stop loss if I go out to the store or something like that. You know, or these aren't day trades. Yeah, physical stop loss on swing trades, I probably won't place one. You know, but if I'm away from the market for an extended period of time, I'll close my positions out, or I'll have enough faith in them that if they get wiped out, they get wiped out. And because you can't. It's way too dangerous to do that. Again, I'm taking some leeway here in saying that people pay attention to what they own, and maybe that's not true with everyone. If you want to do a position trade, do you place a stop loss if you want a position trade? I mean, yeah, you can. If I was doing it all the time, would I pay? I've been doing swing trades now, you know, relentlessly for what, 15, 20 years, and almost none of them have stops on it. But it's, again, because I'm sitting here every day. I know what's going on with that. So, yeah, are you a part-timer? Do you have to put protection? Yeah, you have to protect yourself. But my feeling for a part-timer is that if you can't watch the market – and you need a stop loss, you're probably trading way too big. You should be trading smaller and taking smaller profits and losses and probably not getting stopped out a heck of a lot less and sleeping at night just as well, rather than getting a big position that you want to be right in. Because you know what? When you have a big position you want to be right in, I hate to break it to you, but you're not that smart when you have big positions you want to be right in. I know I'm not that smart. I know I'm wrong a lot more often than I'd like to be. But that's why I diversify through lots of different things. And so if you get a highly correlated event where everything goes in one direction, I think you're pretty much screwed regardless of what you have. I think if you're not sitting there, you're going to get your stop's not even going to fill. So, and that's what the flash crash people found out. Their stops didn't fill for 30, 40 points.
Okay, so let's just say for those who are placing physical stops, right? Ideally, they're in a place that's not obvious. Okay, where would you suggest is perhaps a more advantageous place to put your stop loss, if that's something you feel most comfortable doing?
You're gonna have to go outside of a weekly range, and you also have to remember that the algos, one of the things they do is they look at average true range, and they will always go and spike average true range to try to catch stops that are outside of a certain range. So if you think a stock is only moving 0.75% or 1.4% a day on average, and you put it at 3.4% out, this algo is going to find a way to increase volatility to get that stop, unless you're in a directional market. If you're in a directional market, the algo is not going to do anything about it. We haven't been in a directional market since 2014 in U.S. equities. I know the Australian dollar has had a directional market in that time. You know, and other things have had directional markets, but we haven't had them in U.S. equities or U.S. indices. So for us, it's been very much a trap market where the algos are playing with ranges to take out stops. But if you're going to do it, it really needs to be outside of a weekly range. Take a weekly usually technical way to do it is take a weekly Bollinger Band and keep your stop outside the level of the weekly Bollinger Band. And that's going to tell you how much the volatility is stretching in that environment. I'm not really a percentage guy because percentages are kind of stupid. People put percentages of their total account size because it sounds like a very structured way of controlling risk. But you can't control a risk if you're taking positions for the wrong reasons. You're already taking weight. You've already destroyed your risk profile by getting the wrong stocks because your strategy isn't working. So, you know, your percentages aren't going to help you. So if you're still trying to be guided by finding your way in this dark universe of profits and losses, you want to get it out of the way of what's happening this week. Think in terms, if you're holding for in a weekly to monthly time frames, you want to get them out of the way of a weekly range.
Fair enough. Good point. So last question for you, Alan. Before we finish this off here, are there any final words of wisdom you'd like to share with traders who perhaps feel as though they're not really making any progress and maybe just kind of spinning their wheels?
You need to try something different. I know everybody needs trading education. You're going to get your share trading education. It's become as cheap as it ever has and become in the history of mankind with the internet. But the problem with trading education is there's so much of it available that you can't find the stuff that works for you. The stuff that works for you, you not only find through trial and error, but you have to look yourself in the mirror, dudes and dudettes, and decide what's working for you and decide if you need to build your own system from scratch with what you already know rather than relying on someone who appears to be successful to you right now. And once you start to build your own system based on your own intuition, your own input, and your own skill set, then you'll start to put together a profitable system that meets your qualifications in terms of backtesting. You know, I know everybody wants a backtest, but you have to go and trust yourself before you backtest. No, anybody else's system, it's okay to take bits and pieces from, but you're going to have to come up with your own way of doing stuff. And that starts with the basics that I've talked about. I haven't talked about anything that's very esoteric. You know, folks don't understand me. I tell them straight. You really look them in the eye and you tell them the real straight stuff on how to make money in the market. And then they look at you like wide-eyed, like they don't know what planet you're from. And it's really the same risk stuff that's been – you know, before the algo showed up, before SO showed up, before portfolio insurance showed up, before the Nifty 50 showed up, and that's risk management. You got to control your losses, you know, and then you control your losses and find your own way of doing things. You'll build a winning strategy.
Sound advice. Very good, Alan. Well, where can listeners go to find out more about you? Where's the best place?
The best place right now is in Investopedia, and I'll post that link for you, but it's kind of a long link. I'm in the process of giving them over most of my stuff. But you can find me also on Twitter at MST Trader, MSTTRADER. And I've got a very nice following, and you're welcome to come by and say hi there.
Okay, excellent. And where can someone grab a copy of your book? It's available on Amazon, right?
It's available on Amazon. It's also available now in 7 different languages. You can get it anywhere in Asia. It's in Japanese, Korean, and Chinese. I know it's in German, it's in Portuguese and Spanish and Russian and French, excuse me.
Wow, very cool, very cool. Well, I'll make sure to include a link to that in the show notes at chatwithtraders.com. So, Alan, thanks a heap for coming on the podcast, man. It's been a whole lot of fun speaking with you, and I appreciate it.
You've come to the end of this episode of Chat with Traders, but don't worry, more great episodes are on the way. To stay updated with each great new episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, and we'd love it if you leave us a rating and review. We'll see you next time on Chat with Traders.